My name is Stan Jones. On behalf of the Howell Architecture Library and the College of Architecture, I'm proud to present Dr. Paolo Soleri.
There are a few seats. I don't know, since it's mostly visual, if you like to try to come look forward. There are a few scattered around. You're going to see an attempt to suggest alternatives to the kind of urban conditions that we have been developing in the West and definitely in the States. We don't seem to be able to get away from it, and I think that it's very important to try to define options, and to define options is going to take a long haul, quite a bit of work and time and investment in order to define options. So prototyping or modeling and testing, I think, is one of the essential tasks of any kind of society that wants to have an openings on the future. We seem to be not willing to do that. And one reason is that it's very expensive to experiment on urban problems. Another one is that we are really sold to the notion that what we have been developed now, it's the best of all possible choices, and we are stuck with it. And I think that's not just dangerous, but at this point is also very demeaning. So what you're going to see is what I think it's not an exception, but it's a rule. And the exception being the kind of Los Angeles syndrome that we have been developing in the last two generations, let's say. So before that happened, and it happened for many reasons, not just because of the automobile, before that happened, there was another kind of view on how to live together. So I feel that I am in a tradition of things, not trying to get away from it. I'm going to have 300 slides. You think you could reach and turn on the two? And the first series, it's just an opening, a visual opening, some kind of a warm-up, which I'm not going to explain. But the title of the presentation is The Two Sons of Arcology. Arcology is the combination of architecture and ecology. Two Sons refers to the existence of those two resources, the physical resource and the one that is, it's an offspring of this resource, which is life in general and the human life in particular. So there is a physical radiance and there is a human and physiological radiance. Those two have to be present whenever we think in terms of human habitats within an ecological frame of reference. Many of you might have seen the foundation. This is the layout of the foundation, which happens gradually without any predetermined plan. This is where we have the office, the ceramics, the foundry, the exhibition space, the entrance, one of the residences, the swimming pool, the canopy, etc., etc. As I was saying, could we turn off those lights? I'm going very quickly through some visual things. Thank you. Thank you. Something that I was playing with in the 50s, the beginning of the interest in urban questions, and this was a very simple-minded logistical network, roads with the automobile in mind. And but there was a certain topography which was defined by a little lake, a little dam, and so on. And around this topography, I was trying to develop a network of flow. So that was it. There wasn't very much depth in it. This was a much more complex study, the Mesa City project, where since I was beginning to be interested in ecological questions, I was trying to put within this idea some of the reflections of this interest. For instance, there were processing plants which were serving as the transformation of liquid and solid waste into chemicals or minerals or whatever that would be fed back into industries and into farming. There were, the main feature was villages between 2,000 and 3,000 people organized around an inner garden and surrounded by a larger garden. Those villages were connected with local centers of market and civic activities. But the main resource serving those villages were a network of industries and marketing places and a smaller one of home industries and markets. There was a large learning center in here. There was a fairly large theological center in here. And the connection between those two centers was the development of a quarry. And this quarry, which would be serving the need of in aggregate and possibly something like lime or even cement, this quarry was progressively transformed while exhausting itself into a garden. So this is a geology which is transformed through the intervention of man into a neo-geology, which is a landscape with a number of features. So the closing of a cycle there, the attempt of closing of a cycle there, basically the idea was still very much geared to modes which I think I began to think then that they were not sufficient to serve well the needs of an intense urban life. In other words, if you are there, in order to get there, you might have to spend 20 minutes or whatever, and plus energy, plus investments in whatever is the mode that you're using and so on. So that very physical fact made me to move into a direction which is almost the opposite. Instead of having a big pizza, where you develop an habitat, you build a three-dimensional solid, more or less, which is the idea of ecology. So you minimize, you implode all this system into something that might be comparable to that much, or maybe that much. And that's what I will get into a little later. In the 50s, I was interested in solar energy, and this was an application that I met to MIT from Italy. I didn't get anywhere, but anyhow, I was proposing some work in seeing how solar energy could be captured, maybe stored partially, and also fed into a building. And the building would have been a residential building or a mix of activities. So in this case, you see the greenhouse develop into a chimney, a water tank that could have been connected with some of the storage, heat sink, and so on. And then with different kinds of diagrams, I was trying to use the wind, multi-directional winds, tides, waterfalls, like in a dam condition and so on. Nobody was interested in those things at that time, so slowly I drifted away from specifically from those things. But I kept trying to do something that was connected with the sun, and you'll see that in the apsis later on. The diagram representation used to be a methodology which was referring to effects. There were effects related to inorganic energy, effects related to the organic energy, the effects related to the human condition. In the inorganic energy, I have the greenhouse effect, the chimney effect, the apse effect, and I will go over those at a certain point. In the organic energy, I have the horticultural effect, which is the cultivation, intensive cultivation of foodstuff, mainly vegetables, but also protein, animal proteins possibly into a greenhouse condition. And the mental energy was the human, social, cultural, political, economic, aesthetic, and so on. And this is the most difficult part of the presentation. It relates to what I call the urban effect. and I will go into that later. After Bose, I had a very brief survey of the first generation ecologists, the ones in an MIT book, where I had diagrams and models. Very theoretical, very hypothetical, very symbological, more than anything else. Then I had the empirical process, the prototyping, which is a Cosanti. Then I moved into the transformation of the first generation ecology into the second generation, where the sun is pulled in and is made to be one of the main actors within the urban landscape. And I have models and some diagrams about this. And ultimately, the transformation of our Cosanti, because of this intervention, into a new model, which you'll see at the end of the presentation. As it is now, I somehow rearrange the presentation. I go through the Cosanti, the empirical process first, so that you can grasp some of the concrete things that we are doing. Then I move briefly into the theoretical idea of ecology. Then I'll try to explain the effects, and very specifically the urban effect. That's when you'll go to sleep. And then I'll move into the two sons ecology with the recent models, and then the Cosanti under these changed conditions. So the prototype, I don't know how many of you have been at the Cosanti. It's about 70 miles on Black Canyon Highway at Cordes Junction, which is there, 2 miles from the site. As you know, this is grassland, 3,700 feet above sea level. I picked this ledge of out of 860 acres that the foundation owns, and on this ledge, by using only less than 2% of the site, we are building Cosanti. After setting up the camp about 8 years ago, where we have water, power, and shade, and so on, we began the construction. The construction is painfully slow because the money is coming in by the eyedrop or whatever. And one of the main resources to go on with this construction is people coming and working with us and paying for work. That means that quite hopefully they are learning something. We have meetings. This is a before breakfast, looking at the site in the shade because it's summer, a meeting. We have at least one of those meetings with myself once a week. Then they have a number of meetings among themselves with the staff and so on. So they come, they pay, and they work about between 5 and 6 weeks or longer. So with the money, we buy materials, energy, know-how, and equipment, and so on. And then they put their own labor toward the construction. So it's a double kind of help that we are receiving from people, and they're mostly young people, students, and we are constantly trying to recruit, naturally. And then we are matching those funds with what we do at the foundation. This is the Cosanti original activity, bells in ceramics, bells in metal, small, big, inexpensive, or very expensive. Some commissions. This is done in Phoenix in front of the library, between the library and the museum. Small pieces that I do in styrofoam, and then they are translated in metal. Sketches that I've been doing lately, also on the market, to raise funds. And this is part of the early model, which has been almost abandoned, totally transformed. This is the camp about 3 years ago with some of the organic vegetable grown. The campsite, I mean the building site is up there. This is a view from the south looking at the slope, which is eventually going to be a greenhouse. And then the bulk of the building, which is transformed now, but it's still 25 story high. And what of this early model we have in construction, two vaults, two residences with offices, ceramics, foundry, and restaurant with exhibition and so on. And at the same scale, you can see them there. This is the kind of subsoil that we have. It's basaltic rock. And this is the view from near the highway from the west, part of the early model. And of this early model, as I say, we build two vaults, one and two in the north side, residences and so on. We use some of the techniques that we have been working with in Scottsdale, which means I think it's a little too high. We went We go in the riverbed, we take the silt, which is very fine sand, mixed with some kind of bentonite or whatever. It's all natural, we are not adding anything. And this silt, this very fine sand, is packed, and then it's patterned sometimes, and painted with cement colors. And by starting with the, let's say, with the skin, you end up by having the skin incorporated in the structure. This is the foundation for this vault. And this is the final unit assembled. And the second vault was added about 3 years ago, so now we have a fibroid space, which is where we assemble modules in steel or in carpentry. Then we have we can do many things there, including performances, dinners, or, concerts, and so on. The same technique, somehow using the silt as a bond breaker. This is a slab, and you might pour a unit, a module in the slab. Instead of using a bond breaker, a chemical bond breaker, you can put the silt. You can pour liquid silt, let's say, and then by doing that, you invest the silt on the surface, which is shown there. This is the ceramics apse, and it's like an acoustic shell with the opening toward the south. That means that the winter sun is allowed to penetrate on the working area throughout the winter. The closer you move toward the heat of the summer, the less sunshine you get. To the point where in the middle of the summer you get quite a large shaded area, working area. So I call this some kind of a passive sun machine, because through the shape, through the morphology of the system, you obtain this climate, which is quite good winter and summer in this kind of climate, where you have quite a bit of sunshine. And winter days are quite warm if you can be surrounded by a shell which separates you from the cold radiations, and at the same time you have the sunshine pouring in. The sun, as I was saying, is the opposite. So this is the ceramics apse, and the process has been built using silt again as one of the molding materials. The inside of a residence, showing again the use of silt. And this is the foundry, which is somehow the same kind of apse, but is surrounded at the second level by two residences, two independent rooms, and two studios connected with the residences, two-level studios. So the same procedure here, using the silt, the very rough forming, the finished form, where we are cutting patterns, we are putting colors, and we are putting reinforcing steel, as you see there. So this is the forming, the negative, that's the resulting structure. This is the finished apse, the foundry with the residency, with the two studios, the ceramics, one of the residences, one of the vaults, and then there, the four-story building, which is now almost completed. That's the foundry. In that building, there are some private rooms at this level with services on the north side, a two-level place which will be eventually a restaurant with a mezzanine, where we have a cafe now, and again the service on the north side, and an exhibition space on top. Exhibition, restaurant, residences. This is the landscaping between the buildings. In there, the inside of the restaurant. We are using local stones for the retaining walls. This is the ceramics. It didn't take too long to find out that those buildings were responding to a number of needs, or they define somehow new needs, and that's what I mean when I say that quite often the form comes before the function. And this is the lab on the north side of the two vaults, where we are going to develop graphics and some woodwork. And returning to this question of what comes first, the function or the form, those forms define a very good condition for festivities, celebrations, and so on. So we might have a small concert or a mime or a speaker doing something there, and then we have a little theater there. And also you can project those sounds and lights at night, for instance, and go there and listen and look. So we have the three festivals. The first week of October, the first weekend of October is the festival period. This October we are going to have 4 days. The conference is going to based, which is part of the festival, is going to be on the subject of the arts and the environment for very specific reasons. But for instance, the last 3 years we set up a stage on the bottom of this slope, and that's where we had the main performances. The smaller performances were going on in the vaults, in the apsis, and also in the restaurant. This was the opening of last year festival. Last year, subject of the conference was health, healing, and self-reliance. This was one of the meetings in Foundry Apps. We had dancers, many groups from Arizona and outside of Arizona. The people in what is the temporary cut for the amphitheater. We can serve about 3,000 or 4,000 people here, and then if you go into the main slope, then you can go up to many tens of thousands. At a certain point, we had dancers all over the structures. There, on ceramics, foundry, stage, and so on. This is the ceramics. We have a very good man that from New York that does beautiful banners. This year we are going to have probably kites, many kites and banners. You know this man, Lieberman? Who? Lieberman. We have minorities in this conference about health, you know, self-reliance, Indians, Chicanos, blacks. So this is the relationship of a stage which eventually will be built, the greenhouses in which the stage will be incorporated, the large possibility of many thousands of people on a natural amphitheater, and the buildings which are performing, are part of the performing act. So we have geology, climate, hour of the day, people, groups, all the things working together, and quite well. Louis Falco, a group from New York. Dances under the vault. One of the meetings last year, again, with Betty Friedan, Mel Roman from New York, and so on. And we had American Indian group. Some of the shots at night, and this is a procession of children's with Japanese lanterns, I think 70 children's, the two cranes. And then we got the vault, we had the welding going on, while we had acrobatics there. In the foundry we had grinding going on, and then we had shadow playing of dancers against the walls or through the windows and so on. At the same time we had music going on, so that the whole thing was coordinated. It was not the best coordination, but it began to show the potential of the site. Welding, grinding, again welding, light. And then on the opposite side, we had the spectators with the main stage, and then we had things going on the cliff, along the slope, groups of dancers, processions, and so on. And finally, in this group of slides, the swimming pool, which originated with the idea that we would try to use the sun as a heater. So we cut the platform along this slope, where we have a nice cliff, the rock formation there. We put a bed of rocks about 2 feet high, which is going to be a perforated bed where the hot air from the greenhouse is going to be conveyed under to the chimney effect. So sloping greenhouse, hot air conveying itself under and venting along the rock. The rock themselves are going to accumulate quite a bit of energy. The sun is quite low in the winter, so this warms up and begins to radiate. So the combination of those two things should be sufficient to raise the temperature up to the point where you can swim even in the winter. The swimming pool is almost completed now. We are trying to open it by May. This is the view from the north. This is going to be a part of the deck. The deck is finished. This is the engine, the equipment room. This is the sloping toward the south. That's the camp. This is going to be a water pond, hopefully, eventually, and that's farming land. Our land goes up to the power line there. Now I'm leaving Arcosanti to come back to it at the end to show the transformation of the model, of the general structure, and I'm going through very quickly the earlier ecologies. The fundamental notion is that life is a very intense phenomenon, very complex. The most complex thing that we can anticipate throughout the universe in terms of life or a phase of this complexity. And so the notion is that there is no way by which we can simplify or return to conditions of more elementary association or culture and so on. We're going to be more complex, never more simple, because that goes against the grain of conscience, consciousness, mental work and so on. So you get a paradigm, if you work on that long enough, you get a paradigm where you find out that you have more life where you have more complexity, you have more complexity where you have more miniaturization, and I'll get into that a little later. But that's the guideline for the idea that any kind of habitat has to be very, very conscious of that paradigm. In the MIT book are the illustration of those. I have, I don't know, 24 or 30 or so ideas. We developed some, we put them in the book. This was a floating system. You have a collection and transformation of materials from the sea, fish, mineral, chemicals, whatever. The consumption on the spot and also the export. The export would define some of the capability of this community to survive and so on. Eventually you would build urban ribbons connecting those units of those harvesting and processing units. So this could become a floating metropolitan system on a continental shelf. The same notion, something floating in the water in different kinds of structural and performing terms. The idea of a dam that, in a way, it's a wasted gigantic masonry, in the sense that the same masonry could contain, besides being a container of a flow, it could also be a container of life. So by design intent, you can take the idea of a dam and make it into an idea of a city dam. If it's small, it could be a resort center. If it's large, it could be a metropolitan system. Water is available for energy, for farming, domestic purposes, recreation, power production, and so on. And sometimes those sites are quite striking and beautiful. You think you could put the other one? Thank you. I have a series of very rough models to indicate somehow, to show a parallel between the Empire State Building as a size and what those ideas in terms of community could be. This was a suggested, something like less than 20,000 people, a community in on a hot climate where the community itself becomes the big umbrella, the big parasol for the main staging of public activities. Saitai, thank you. This was still in the dam thing. So this was a unit that I tend to suggest as a farm town for farmers, which might sound strange in this country. It's very normal in Asia and Europe. Most of the farmers live in towns. This is the same thing for this one. It could be a farming town where the families of the farmer might choose to live in an habitat which can offer resources beyond the farm condition. Again, the Empire State Building to indicate the size. Now, I'm showing this because I'm constantly saying that we are not involved in megastructures. We are involved in mini-structures. The reason is that this, if you develop this two-dimensionally, you get something which you get a structure which might be 20 times as big. So you move from a very large let's say, pizza structure, pancake structure, to a very small three-dimensional structure. So it's a miniaturization of the urban landscape. This is the inside of the second one that you saw, indicating mainly the those spaces which could be commercial, public, social, and so on, because we are trying to keep the exterior for the urban, for the private conditions, you know, homes, apartments, and so on. Another example in this series, about 1 million population, and the main point to make here that, again, since you are you become pedestrian due to the mini landscape, by being a pedestrian, you eliminate the automobile. The automobile has no access. There are no roads, period. There are only streets, arcades, plazas, and whatever it's acceptable and desirable for people and not for automobiles. You can walk throughout it. If you live here, you can have your grandparents there or vice versa. That means that you are not sitting on top of each other, but you have this access on a daily basis without the need of devices like the automobile and so on, and that means that the child can do that, the nurse can do that, the businessman can do that, and you find out that your life can be enriched by eliminating those gaps in time, space, frustration, energy, pollution, and so on. The fact of a minimized landscape defines an immediate contrast between the cityscape, the man-made, and the open country, which I think, again, it's a very crucial element to survey, especially for the underprivileged. Usually when you are trapped in a city, which is the poor loses sight. I mean, it doesn't have access to nature. And if you think of the children put in that kind of condition, you see how squalid life might become. So this is an attempt also to define this continuous connection between the habitat, which can be crucially intense, and the outside, it's almost the opposite. Services, utilities, and so on would be minimized in terms, again, of length, of a section in, floor, and also the administrations probably could be cut down, which means you begin to see the possibility of the reduction of bureaucratic machines, remoteness due to that, and all the consequences of feeling impotent within a gigantic system. This implies saving in terms of ecological sanity, saving of land, saving of water, saving of energy, saving of materials. And if you can get the sun to work into it, then you introduce this additional element in terms of a democratic kind of resource. The non-dependence from large governmental or corporate systems for your resources in terms of energy. Could you do the same thing? Thank you. So we had a number of models. They're not all here, but I hope you got some ideas of why the third dimension being introduced. Two more examples. One is the concept of the linear city. This is a very, very rough model, but the concept, if you cut through here, again, in a very simplified way, you have at the center, you have a logistical network. That's where automobiles, trains, pneumatic transportation, and even air transportation would be the bulk of the logistical network. That means that you could plug them to this network communities from the very small to the very large. And by doing that, you have this transportation network very close to your house. You have your house embedded into the social and public and cultural institutions of the city. And again, you have immediate contact with the open land. If you break down this, you get the unsolvable problems of the diaspora, where things become unmanageable and you lose touch. Social touch with nature, and your civilization seems to be on the brink of collapse. Linear city means a continuity. Continuity would mean, in some instances, the bridging of some obstacle like a canyon or a river and so on. Again, extremes to illustrate the possibilities according to a certain approach, which is, again, complexity and implosion. And last in this series, the idea that airports are really places where no one is interested in going or coming from. So why not build a city instead of an airport? Well, a big airport employs more than 100,000 people, so you have already an embryonic city there. So the question would be to redesigning and see in it the quality of permanence and intensity that belongs to a city. So in this case, according to a certain wind pattern near New Jersey, we suggested the landing strips. Suppose you land, the engine is turned off, the aircraft is pulled in this taxiing ring, and you're practically disembarking or getting onto the plane at the center of the city. The city is never flown on top because everything is tangential to it. This is the taxiing ring. Those are indications of industries below grade. The grade would be a green belt, and this is the bulk of the city, in this case about 1 million population. We developed some diagrams indicating the time gaps between activities, so it's a question of hundreds of feet instead of tens of miles, and it's a question of minutes or seconds instead of dozens of minutes and so on. The consumption of energy would be reduced, the pollution would be almost eliminated, and you can enrich your life if this landscape is well-defined and if it becomes a very exciting place to travel through. It's a mini landscape. Now I'm trying to explain the urban effect, which is based on this idea of complexity miniaturization, and I'm beginning from the very beginning, and I cannot read it. Could you zoom a little? Thank you. A little more? That's good. This is a diagram somehow based on a Western view of the cosmos, the evolutionary process. It's a process, it's not a state, no matter what you look at. So you have a mass energy universe, which is the basis of this process. The deterministic way is deterministic because somehow there are rules that we think are unchangeable, the laws of gravitational law, electric, chemical, whatever. And it's a cosmogenesis, and I tend to call it the universe of indifference, and listed here are characterizations which are very much pertinent to the idea of the urban effect, the problem of the consciousness, mental processes, social processes, cultural processes, and the city. This universe is insensitive, structural, simulable, predictable, granular, rational, statistical, entropic, and segregational, the physical universe. An offspring or the possibility of this becoming something else has been exemplified at least on one spot, the Earth, the genetic way, the biogenesis, the biological universe, the universe of innocence, if you see it mainly as plants and animals. It is social, cooperative, sensitized, non-simulable, irreversible, selective, evolutionary, durational, unconscious, and instinctual. Offspring of this, again, in terms of at least one spot, in the universe is the cultural way, the human universe, the homogenesis, the universe of conscience, good and evil. It's cultural, social, cooperative, compassionate, non-simulable, willful, irreversible, evolutionary, durational, conscious, mental, and so on, aesthetic. Then some kind of an extrapolation, the sacramental way, the divine universe, the theogenesis. It is seminal, aesthetic, resurrectional, totalizing, loving, irreversible, non-simulable, genentropic, the universe of transcendence. It will appear very quickly that in this diagram, at least from my point of view, grace is not at the origin, but could be, is potentially at the end. It's a possibility. We can anticipate the possibility of grace at the end. By grace, I mean total knowledge, total wisdom, total beauty, and so on. So you move from the simple, relatively speaking, to the complex, utterly complex. You move from the non-conscious, or what we call the non-living, into the conscious and living, and so on. And beside those characterization, or repeating and emphasizing those characterization, you could say that this is development and an escalation of cooperation, compassion, liveliness, intensity, interdependence, association, sensitivity, response, self-reliance, learning, memory hierarchy, knowledge, passion, anticipation, care, transcendence, reverence, synergy, and so on. And this seems to be pointing at the fact that evolution, when it's successful, is a process of moving into more complex system where you have more interaction, more cooperation, more understanding, more knowledge, and so on. To somehow illustrate the case of this complexity ever growing and miniaturization related to complexity, I take the seed I planted, and I suggest that the process of the seed becoming a tree is not so much the explosion of the seed into something bigger, but the implosion of environmental elements into something very small, intensely organized, synergistically active, able to reproduce itself, and so on. So from the soil you get minerals, including water. Distances are measured in centimeters or kilometers. In the air you have another story. You really have a cosmic coordinate in terms of light, energy coming in, hundreds of thousands of miles, and so on. And those elements which are scattered, like let's call them photons and minerals and so on, they come, they are captured, they are elaborated, they are made into the organism. So the photosynthetic process connected with the chemical processes, biochemical processes of the seed becoming a tree, are this phenomenon of complexity and miniaturization. The tree is one example. It can be any kind of animal organism. It can be an association of animals. It can be an association of people or peoples. But the indication of 3,000 millions of years is that this is the way by which matter becomes sensitized and eventually could become spirit. So you have a mass energy universe in which you have the parameter of time space as devices by which this mass energy universe tends to become possibly at a certain point the seed of itself. So in a way the genesis of this process is to produce the ultimate genes, which is the idea of divinity, grace, and so on. Now, on the Earth, we call this process the ecological dynamics. So if you think that there might be an end or an eschatological meaning to it, you could say that the ecological process is a teleecological process, is an attempt at a certain point developed by the universe to find the meaning of itself, and by doing that, to transfigure itself into logos, knowledge, and so on. Now, what I've been presenting defines a certain model which is almost the opposite of the traditional model. The traditional model says that reality exists somehow completed. What we are doing is to try to understand what it is through the process of learning and through the evolutionary process. But God is there, perfect. You can call it God, Nirvana, Truth, Logos, or whatever. But it exists, and it might be it might be observing, or it might be guiding, but it is there. So this is the revelational universe. Whatever we do, it's in a way an uncovering of an existing truth. The model I'm suggesting is very different. You're not uncovering the truth, you're creating it. And most of this truth doesn't exist yet, because the future is in a way much more dense of potential than the past has been. So you have an empty socket, which is the future. And this empty socket is begging for to be created. In attempting to create this future, we anticipate and we produce religious structures. So divinity is a blueprint that we have invented. Now we have to realize it by the process of evolution. So this is the evolutionary model or the creational model. And the two have implications in terms of ethics and social and cultural, which are quite different in emphasis, at least. I will stay with those, but a repetition of the first diagram in different form. If you accept the notion of the Big Bang, you could imagine that at that point the universe begins to act. It goes from being into becoming. Within this becoming, you have the origin of nodules of consciousness, like on the Earth. those are beginning to transform this phenomenon into something else. So it's the media, the original media, without any message that eventually could become a message which has consumed the media. Or it's reality going out as matter and coming in as spirit. Using the complexity, miniaturization coordinates and having a time coordinate on 45 degrees, as a diagram, you could suggest that there are two extremes, which are, one is represented somehow by the Western mode ethos, and the other by the Eastern ethos. This is a very gross simplification, but just as to try to make the point. In the West, we tend to be very clever, in fact, extremely clever in defining system by which miniaturization is quite evidently a goal. Take the technology of the computer. We are tremendously successful in moving toward a miniaturization. What we are lacking sometimes is the motivation for that, or the motivation tends to be matter-oriented, materialistic. The consumerist society is a very good example. So we have idolatry of matter, forgetting that perhaps this is in function of something greater than matter itself, which is spirit. On the East, you might have the opposite condition, where there are constructions which are very complex in terms of spiritual models, religious notions, traditions, and myth, and so on. But there is a tendency, perhaps, or there was a tendency to ignore the physical, from the physiological to the environmental. So you have a continuous critical situation in terms of health, for instance, and so on. So in this case, you have an idolatry of spirit, which is contrapposed to the idolatry of matter. My suggestion is that we should be able to find a more balanced situation so that we can move into this evolutionary thrust with better success, which is what this tends to represent. Could you balance? No, wait a second, maybe I can still... Yeah, could you make this a little bigger at this point? Now, I'm coming down from the very general model, which entails a certain theological reference to the conditions of society, especially the Western society, and relating those to this possibility of transforming the habitat so that it might be more responsive to the critical condition that we are in. I'm saying that this idea of complexity miniaturization, if applied, and I call that the ecological commitment, you would have an alleviation of the ecological crisis, a redimension of our use of land, air, and water, a reduction of the pollution caused by technological societies, the perception of the nature of waste, affluence, and opulence, a reasonable sheltering of man, which is moving now beyond the 4 billions and might go up to 10 or more billions of individuals, the resolution of the problem of energy depletion, distribution, and consumption, the resolution of the problem of segregation of people, things, and activities, responding to the increasing encroachment of remoteness by way of the gigantic system that we are developing, like Phoenix, and the services that which have to be connected with them, the bureaucratic machines, and so on. The next step is to move into the effects that I pulled out from the many that it can work with to define a physical model. So you have the horticultural effect within a greenhouse condition, two effects there. The apse effect, which I explained briefly at the beginning, the ability of some structure to shade themselves during the summer where the sun is high and to get quite a bit of sunshine and accumulate this energy in the winter. The chimney effect connected with this factor of moving air in a certain way. And then in addition, the ability of structures of bulk, of mass, to accumulate energy, to store energy, and then giving it out, for instance, when the temperature surrounding it is lower than the temperature that has built up into the building. So that's the heat sink effect, which makes for five effects. And those five effects, you see four there illustrated, we are trying to make them work around the urban effect. And coming back quickly to the urban effect, it's that kind of phenomenon which seems to be originating at the very beginning of life, where particles are becoming conscious of each other, they begin to work out, they transform themselves, and they develop this synergistic process by which life becomes possible. So embryonically or no, within the weather region, let's say a virus, you have already synergy, intensity, consciousness of some sort, transcendence, frugality, sensitivity, beauty, knowledge, interdependence, coordination, compassion, and so on. They begin there, they accelerate their formation, and eventually they become very evident in the nature of man, and actually in what man is doing as a social animal, a cultural animal. So you could suggest again that the urban effect, it's very central to the evolutionary process, and in a way it could be seen as that kind of impulse which will make eventually for the development of the ultimate logos, divinity or whatever. Now, very modestly, we are trying to get those five effects working around the urban effect in one system. By doing that, we would be saving on resources, land, water, time, energy. We would save in minerals, and we would have an ecological, better ecological sanity. We would cut on pollution, segregation, waste, bigness, bureaucracies, isolation, alienation, and so on. We would point at better possibility in learning, in integrity, in reach, in health, in identification, and cooperation, and so on. The next step is to move into a natural spatial diagram. So I take the greenhouse as a guiding element. I begin with the greenhouse as a flat surface sheltered by a skin, transparent skin. You need equipment and energy to ventilate the greenhouse, especially in the summer months, depending naturally where you are in the climate. But if you stop the greenhouse, you can get most of the ventilation, if not all of it, through the chimney effect. Naturally, you can vent that energy, accumulated energy, outside or inside something. You can put a greenhouse as an envelope around the house. You can build a dome of some sort and build levels of activities within the dome. You can make a greenhouse into a wafer where only the energy collected is used, so that you have a sun collector which can be incorporated one way or the other into the structure of the house. You can maintain the two assets or the two characteristics of the greenhouse, food production and energy collection in terms of warm air, for instance. If you stop the greenhouse, you have this possibility of using, again, the chimney effect or the raising of the air into the house, for instance, in winter conditions. You can transform the house into a collection of houses or other institutions so that you begin to see the connection between that kind of mode and the village or the town or the metropolitan system. You take the town as such and you transform it in terms of a sensitization with the sun, to the sun, which is the apse effect, at least one way of doing it. In addition, there you have a better capability of the structure to accumulate energy. Again, especially if you start to work it with that notion. So here you have the five effects connected, working around the urban effect. So that's the typical section of the Toussaint's ecology. An example which is the most elementary one which we have been working on, it's a possible public center on a public park where you have a natural slope. This is near India, in California. A natural slope, you cut a ditch, you build shelves, you put a membrane as a greenhouse, so you have the greenhouse, chimney effect, horticultural effect. Then you begin to have some sort of heat sink and urban effect there because you have a number of things like lectures, projections, little collections and so on, like a museum. So this is a very simple application of those five effects plus one. You can move from that very simple to the very, very highly complex that could be a town of many thousands of people or many hundreds of thousands of people. Going back to the apse effect to illustrate again the notion, this is a shot in the summer, this is a shot in the winter. The only difference is this is midday, this is before the sun comes on the south side. But anyhow, it's still clear that in this case the sun pours in very, very deep for many hours a day, so you have sunshine and you have sheltering from the cold radiations. In this case, you have shade sheltering from the hot radiations. So that's the apse effect, again illustrated here by a winter shot and a summer shot. About 3 years ago, we were able to get some help from the Xerox Corporation, and the Bicentennial Commission came in, so we developed a number of models, and they were all based to this notion, the two sons of colleges. The sketches here represents the introduction of awnings, which could become a very great asset to enlarge the shade volume within this system, which, especially in a climate like Phoenix or Arizona, it's one of the key elements for the climate of a system. So eventually we made a model. We exposed the model to a sun machine to see how effectively the apse effect was working. And basically this is the model that you're going to see repeated a number of times. A sun collector in terms of a greenhouse which produces food for local consumption or export or both, and the greenhouse feeds directly, passively, into the main mall that it could be a marketplace, a bazaar, or something else, depending a little on the character of the society. But it would be a public place connecting the two main residential and working areas. Spaces, in this case, instead of an apse, is two truncated cones. You can add shade here in the summer, but even if you don't put shade, the building itself is able to shade itself quite successfully. You can see there in June, in December, the solstice, you see sunshine in December, shade in June. We were able to put some effort in finding out how much energy was falling on the structures, how much could be captured and stored, how much could be used, and so on. And then we developed models depending on technologies, on number of peoples, topography, geology, and climate. This was for the Chesapeake Bay, where there was a natural slope on the southeast side, so those are the greenhouses developed on those two slopes and feeding into the building. You keep in mind that those are mainly modes that could be very useful in places where you have lots of sunshine and also possibly a rigid climate, very high changes in temperature, winter and summer, and also night and day. In addition, in those conditions, usually you have a limited amount of water available, so the greenhouse becomes very important because it saves an enormous amount of water for food production. A condition which we compare to some of the climate in Nevada, where we have a slope, south slope, we terrace the slope, we put the membrane fed into the main public space within the town, again a very small town. The transformation of the cone into two straight blades with some kind of the same general results. The use of the same idea for a place in Regina, at the center of the town, they had a rail yard that was moved outside of the town. So there was a competition, we suggested the placement on arcology, where you have, again, the same kind of section, typical section, and above the garages or the warehousing, we developed the greenhouses. It's a very windy region, temperature which can be very rigid, down to 50 or 60 below gray, below zero in the winter, but a great amount of sunshine. So in a way, an ideal spot where we could have developed an intermediate stage, almost an outdoor place, but sheltered from those extremes, wind and temperature. Another example of extremes where the suggestion was that you have greenhouses and then the greenhouses become a garden for the town. In this case, you have to introduce energy because the assumption was that the climate would be very rigid, especially in winter. So that you need some kind of resource like oil, coal, timber industries, so you could use the leftovers and so on. But in this case, the psychological asset would be the main asset. You develop a green outdoor while maybe you have many feet of snow around it and so on. The idea of a dam which somehow has a shape which is very amenable to this kind of use if it's oriented toward the south. Uh, We have many, many ideas to develop. We developed only a few of them. Those were the sketches for the dam. And one was a village which ended up by being called the Indian Village, because a young architect from India was involved in the model. And the same kind of thing, the slope would be partially covered by a greenhouse, that you see only half of that there. And then the village would develop with very elementary technology into this kind of thing, where you have the bazaar and the living quarters and then some other institution for the city, with the same kind of diagram, the feeding of the energy in the winter throughout the village. I'm almost through. This is an idea that I developed in the 50s, and in the 60s we made a little model. It was part of the MIT book. It's a space city. It's a cylinder rotating on this axis. It's lined by vegetation, so you stand inside of this green belt, this bean barrel. And by working at that, if you get really into it, you will find out that you have all the elements which are part of the city mode, but they are exasperated. The most exasperated is miniaturization, evidently, because you have to be very careful in what you do with space. But there is cooperation, interdependence, synergy, learning, memory, all sorts of things are very much basic in this kind of process, because by definition this is a frugal system, which is one reason why we'll eventually move into space. This was picked up, wasn't picked up, but Gerard O'Neill came to me and asked me a suggestion about his space colonies, so I was asked to respond to his ideas. So I made a model, and I wrote a paper. The paper was suggesting that the space is going to be colonized for two fundamental reasons, which are somehow coinciding. One is frugality, the other one is theology. We are going there because that's where the resources are going to be eventually, the unlimited resources, and we are going there because we are going to make the universe into a thinking, conscious phenomenon. It's going to take a few billions of years, but... So this model was transformed into something more complex. This is a barrel about 10 kilometers in length. You have different kinds of gravities the more you move away from the center, and you have about 7 or 8 landscapes, one barrel inside the other one. The first is a technological barrel, where you have all sorts of things, including warehousing on the skin, also as a shell shield. Inside, on that surface, on the inner surface, we have a water condition for storage of water, for aquaculture possibly, and also for as a reflector of energy and light to a hanging garden, which is, let's say, the vegetable gardens on that barrel again. And on top of this skin, of this barrel, you have a landscape which is very much connected with the urban condition, which is, again, a hanging condition, many layers thick, which has also another landscape on the top of it, which means inside of it. And in the center, you have a condition of quasi weightlessness, where you could develop technologies, and including the health technology and so on. And lastly, before the Arcosanti, the idea of an ecology that could be a floating city. So you have the typical section, the greenhouses, and the town, let's say. But in this case, the whole system can be rotated very easily because it's a buoyant system. So you could always follow the sun in such a way as to have an optimal condition, both winter and summer. I suggested the introduction of the iceberg as a resource for fresh water, if fresh water is limited. And the iceberg could also be a refrigeration resource in hot summer months. And then you could make it into a very crazy kind of landscape. Three-dimensional playground, I mean. And this is the intermediate model of Arcosanti, where you see the typical section enveloping existing buildings so that this area becomes a sheltered and basically shaded space in the summer, while in the winter becomes a collector of energy for those buildings. So those are the existing buildings. We are developing now a crescent for 14 units of living, This is what I called the Theodosia, then the cloister, which is a conference center, and we have another crescent here for a guest mainly as a project. And then from this we move into this more detailed model with another kind of structural approach. So we are here now, far from being definite, but that's where we are. The greenhouses on the slope that you have seen at the beginning, the connection with the green, with the main building is 25 story. Each level doesn't have just habitation, have habitations plus activities of different kinds, small industries, private initiatives, and so on. And the main level, the ground level, is where the main social and public activity goes on. The building itself has its own greenhouse conditions because of light and sun coming in the winter, and then becomes a shade in the summer. The building could have extensive awnings connecting the two points, let's say, so that you can add shading there. Not very successful attempt of placating the building, it should come down. But there are two main climate conditions. One is the winter, one is the summer. In the winter you have the intake of cold air, or relatively cold air, to the at the base of the greenhouse. The greenhouses are causing this air to warm up and to rise. The rising, it becomes a chimney-like rising through the building, especially if you boost that with vents or whatever, or everything passive, at least theoretically. In the summer you can reverse the process because of the dryness of the climate. You have openings on top of the greenhouse. You humidify the air through evaporative cooling of some sort, pulverize water or padding or whatever. The air becomes heavy and cool, and it falls throughout the building. You can boost that with different openings at different levels. So theoretically, you have two passive systems of heating in the winter and cooling in the summer. We are working with Environmental Research Center in Tucson, which is furnishing us the elements for the development of this, of the formulas, and they seem to be quite happy with what they're finding out. So as I say, fundamentally, two passive ways by which we climatize. In addition, we would develop hot water systems, sun collectors, for domestic purposes, and in addition, we have the production of food. If you add to that the smallness of the building, the capacity of using it without the use of the automobile, the integrity of this potentially of the community, because it's working within one system, doesn't have the barriers that we are building around ourselves now, and so on, you get an idea of the six effects working together. Well, this is the model of the crescent, which is this combination of 14 units around the theater. The theater is an open theater, but part of it could be enclosed, that we could put a tent. We have a frame for a tent there. And the theater would be where you have a daily cycle of children playgrounds, meeting during the evening or whatever, movies, concerts, and whatever you might have according to a certain schedule, including marketplace. So this would be serving not only the 14 units, but also the people that are beginning to settle at Arcosanti. Those are the existing buildings, the two vaults, one of the residences. I think you don't have to worry too much if you can get it out. This is somehow almost an arrogant parallel between what I call the Los Angeles syndrome and the Arcology syndrome. This is actual, I think, and we probably could agree on most of those things. This is theoretical, because it hasn't been tested today, but has been tested quite a bit throughout history. Because as I was saying, I'm really trying to do the routine, not the exception. You have bigness against smallness, exploitation, fitness, segregation, integration, matter, mind, power, authority, destruction, conservation, pollution on pollution, entropy, genentropy, dimness, intensity, Eden, short, post-Eden, fragmented, structure, exclusive, interiorized, complicated, complex, bureaucratic, performing, opulent, frugal, greedy, cultural, incongruous, and congruous. I'm ready to get some questions now.